Back together again, chatting it up with you, starting a brand new week, Monday, October 7th, 2024, on Connecticut Today, where I pointed to one state that Connecticut could take a big tip from regarding long-term energy security. CBS reporter Robert Berger joined us live from Jerusalem, marking 1 year since the Hamas attack on Israel. Connecticut Inside investigator reporter Catherine Revelo explained a new report outlining the biggest lobbyists at the state capitol, while ConnecticutNewsJunkie.com columnist and Substack blogger Terry Cowgill dropped by with his weekly update. And first things first, right here on WICC 600 AM and 95.9 FM. Keep it right here, top and bottom of the hour. Updates as to Hurricane Milton here. Now, if you or anyone you know has relatives or friends, or you have a home in Florida, some business interest there, Milton has now strengthened into a Category 5 hurricane. Now, it's still a couple of days out from hitting Florida. The projections I'm looking at now are perhaps a Category 3 or 4 hit on the western coastline of Florida, although that's still plenty bad. But right now, in the open waters, as that storm moves from west to east, a Category 5 hurricane, maximum sustained winds of 175 miles an hour. That is pretty darn bad. So we cross our fingers for our friends, our relatives, the people we know with property, some of those from Connecticut here that have moved to Florida for whatever reason. They either snowbird or they have moved there in their retirement years or their enjoyment years, so we keep them in our thoughts and prayers. Once again, that storm right now is a Category 5, maximum sustained winds 175 miles an hour. Forecasters expect that to weaken a bit, but we're talking weakening here maybe by Wednesday morning, and then the projection I'm looking at here would be a Wednesday late p.m., early Thursday a.m. hit directly about mid-state on the western part of Florida with a Category 3 storm. Now, this is not going to crawl up the eastern seaboard. It's going to move across Florida, heading from left to right or west to east, hitting at about a Category 3, and then emerging on the other side of Florida still as a moderate Category 1 storm. Of course, Cat 1 is 75 miles an hour and beyond with that. So we'll keep you up to date here. Again, if you know anybody there, you may want to just check with them. Hopefully they're getting out of the area. Now, again, you will be able to drive north or drive extremely south, you know, maybe toward Miami and the Key West to avoid this. But what they call the cone of certainty or uncertainty certainly does involve a large swath from just about the Florida panhandle south down about two-thirds of the way in the state. So we will be tracking that for you as well. All right, a lot coming up now. I'm going to start with something on Florida, but it's not hurricane-related. We will do that in just a minute here at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. But I just wanted to do that to let you know what was going on there, just in case you want to touch base with family, friends, or relatives down there. About an hour from now, CBS News reporter Robert Berger will be jumping on board for about 5 minutes. He is, of course, a longtime CBS reporter stationed in Israel, so we'll talk to him about this marking 1 year since the Hamas attack on Israel that now has triggered at least 1 year of hostilities here. Israel still battling Hamas in Gaza, still plenty of hostages that have not been returned. Connecticut Inside investigator reporter Catherine Revelo will be with us to talk about a new report later on to the show about which industry groups, which individual organizations spend the most money lobbying lawmakers at the state capitol. Now, you may not realize it or not, but lobbyists are all around the state capitol, not just at the capitol in Washington or anything like that. But Catherine Ravello has taken a look at the lobbyist expenses that are being spent up at the state capitol. And our buddy, our pal, Terry Cowgill, with his every Monday stop by from the Connecticut News Junkie and Substack.com. So we will start with something concerning Florida. And maybe the state of Florida has an answer to what we're struggling with here in the state of Connecticut. But then again, the people at the state capitol are probably going to show their utter arrogance and tell you that, hey, it's in Florida, so it's nothing that we're going to be doing here. And, of course, 1 year ago today, much of the world was stunned at a brazen attack by Hamas forces attacking Israel, and that has precipitated now at least 1 year of increased hostilities and all-out war between forces of Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Robert Berger joins us once again, CBS News in Jerusalem. Robert, thank you for taking the time. I would imagine this has been just a very emotionally tough day for the area that you cover there, sir.
It really has. I mean, starting at 6:30 a.m. local time, which is when the hour when Hamas began that huge terrorist attack on Israel a year ago. Just a reminder, 3,000 armed Hamas militants crossed the border. There were 3,000 rockets were fired and 1,200 people killed. So all day, starting at 6:30 in the morning and then continuing even until now, it's now in the evening over here. These ceremonies, very somber, moving ceremonies, remembering all the people who fell, and the fact against the background of this continuing war that you mentioned.
Robert, a couple of things that a lot of people may not understand here, and I don't think have gotten the play that they should. Was this, in fact, it turns out, a response to a coming normalization of diplomatic relations involving Israel? And I believe it was going to be Saudi Arabia. It was that part of what generated this, that the Palestinians and the Gazans felt that they were being left out of this whole thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a quiet movement, toward a possible regional peace deal that would have included Saudi Arabia, which is really the kingpin there in the Arab world. Israel has made peace with some Arab countries, Jordan, Egypt, United Arab Emirates. And then the hope was this regional peace led by Saudi Arabia. So that was certainly one factor in the timing of this attack. And, you know, it did succeed in that goal, because now Saudi Arabia is saying it is open to peace with Israel, but not until the Palestinian conflict is resolved by the creation of a Palestinian state.
Robert Berger is the guest, CBS News Jerusalem, talking about marking 1 year since hostilities and that attack on Israel. Robert, what about the notion here that this was a large-size intelligence failure that's still being laid at the foot of Prime Minister Netanyahu? How has that played out over the past year?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the question that happened as soon as this attack was an hour or two in is, where was the Israeli military? This happened actually on a Jewish holiday. And so the army, a lot of soldiers were on leave. And even though it turns out now that there were a lot of warning signs that simply weren't heeded, it was a catastrophic security failure. They could have figured it out, but they didn't pay attention to all the warning signs. There was sort of this misconception that Hamas didn't want war and was contained. And that, of course, was totally wrong. So, yes, the political echelon is certainly responsible, even though Prime Minister Netanyahu has not taken responsibility, and also the defense establishment for letting this happen.
And finally, Robert, obviously, we pray for all those hostages that are still being held. But when you look at it from a tactical point of view, and I say this on my show here all the time, what is the impetus for Hamas, especially now as much as they've been depleted over the year, to really give up these hostages and do what some of these rather grief-stricken parents and families want. I mean, they, in a sense, still hold a good number of the cards here, do they not?
Yeah, that's their big card, and you're right. I mean, in a way, the feeling is that Hamas really doesn't have much more to lose. I mean, it doesn't really care about all the civilian casualties going on in Gaza. And it succeeded in a year-long war that's wearing Israel out, basically. The war has spread to Lebanon, which right now has escalated in the past 3 weeks. And we're also bracing for an Israeli attack on Iran after Iran fired 200 ballistic missiles at Israel a week ago. So if you think about Hamas, they might actually think they want to hold out.
Live from Jerusalem, thank you, CBS News correspondent Robert Berger. Thank you, Robert. Be safe, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you. Appreciate it. Robert Berger there, live, CBS News in Jerusalem. And when you hear about the word or the words or the term lobbyists or lobbying, naturally you're thinking may deflect to Washington, because we talk about it a lot on shows like this or on political websites, who's lobbying who on abortion and gun control and insurance stuff. Well, that also goes on, maybe not on the same level or same issues, but it goes on in Hartford. New story out there by Catherine Revelo at the Connecticut Inside Investigator site. $82.2 million in state house lobbying. And who's spending the most? What categories? The aforementioned Catherine Revelo is here to talk about that. Hey, Catherine, it's Paul again. How are you?
Great, Paul. Thanks for having me on the program this afternoon.
Great. Were these numbers easy to get? How easy were these numbers to find, or are they public record? How'd you get these numbers?
So these are actually incredibly easy to find because the Office of State Ethics tracks lobbying information. They track, you know, a variety of categories, things like the issues that people are lobbying, the compensation levels, media spending, and things like that.
Now, it's interesting you just said media spending. I was going to ask you how this breaks down. So, in other words, this isn't, Catherine, correct me if I'm wrong here by what you said, this isn't just salaries for lobbyists or people. In other words, the other categories are built in here?
Right. So they basically break it down into a variety of categories, things like legislative efforts. You know, some of it is administrative costs, and a lot of it is spending on media. And if you read the story on insideinvestigator.org, you'll see that we created a bunch of charts and kind of broke down the information. And one of the things that we tracked was the amount of media spending that the top 10 lobbyists did. And one of the things that we noticed is that spending tends to go way up when the legislature is in session.
Yeah, and we should mention here, Catherine, and I'm sure, you know, some people approach you with this because they call here on the show all the time. This is all above board. I mean, this is all legal, because I think sometimes we hear lobbyists, right, and it's usually connected to D.C., and it's like, oh, it's all underhanded. No, this is perfectly legal.
Yeah, absolutely. The Office of State Ethics, in accordance with state statute, requires basically any lobbyist that spends, I believe it's $3,000 in a year, or commits to doing that amount of lobbying, has to register with the Office of State Ethics and has to make, I believe it's quarterly reports on their activities. And that's the information that office reports.
Okay, so what are the major categories here, Catherine, before we get to the individual organizations or businesses? I'm not surprised as to what the major categories are here.
Yeah, so probably unsurprising, healthcare is far and away the biggest by the number of top 10 lobbyists. Government, by the number of lobbyists that exist, is the most popular, but healthcare is the one that it probably wouldn't surprise most people.
And obviously these are areas, Catherine, you know, healthcare, energy, that, you know, can have tens, hundreds of millions of dollars, right, affected by what lawmakers do, or in some cases don't do. So it doesn't really surprise anybody, does it?
No, probably not, right? The Connecticut Hospital Association was the biggest lobbyist, and Eversource was number two. So those, again, are probably, those are names that come up a lot in the legislature and a lot of bills that the legislature is considering. So it's probably not that surprising that those are up at the top.
Catherine Revelo is the guest. She has a great story. Go check insideinvestigator.org. $82.2 million in State House lobbying, breaking down the top 10 spenders. Catherine, I've always been told, because I was inquiring to people and lawmakers over the years, hey, what is the approach here with lobbyists? And correct me if I'm wrong, they have told me in the past that as well-intentioned as a lawmaker may be, right, some of these bills are hundreds of pages and regulations, as you and I know, written by lawyers, and a lot of what these lobbyists say they try and do is to make lawmakers understand the implications of a vote. Now, obviously, they're pushing their point of view here, but a lot of this really doesn't surprise me, because a lot of legislators, you know, I've talked to, Catherine, have said, man, some of these bills I have to vote on are just voluminous. I can't read the whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's reflected in our report. One of the other things that we did was track from the most recent legislative session the bills that the top 10 lobbyists submitted testimony on, or representatives of those companies did. You know, and one of the things that you see a lot is those representatives saying, you know, we have this issue with this bill, or we like this portion of this bill, but we would like to work with the legislator or the committee that is working on the bill to try to improve the bill.
And it's interesting, too, Catherine, I've spoken to a lot of legislators over the years that when they're done legislating, some of them go to work for lobbyist firms because they really know the ins and outs here.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you can see that if you look at one of the other things that the Office of State Ethics tracks, is the firms that client lobbyists contract with. And you can see a lot of names that cycle through exactly that.
Yeah. Finally, Catherine, anything here surprise you putting a story like this together? I mean, I'm sure there were things that you said, okay, figure that. Were there any one or two wow moments where you just went, that's interesting, or not?
I think far and away the most interesting thing for me was just kind of tracking the bill testimony that representatives of these companies submitted. And one of the things that we looked at was how successful they were in getting their desired outcome of the bill. If they testified in favor of the bill, did it pass, and vice versa? And it's, you know, no one company was really above, I think 80% was the highest. But, you know, for the most part, you know, it doesn't necessarily seem like that testimony is that persuasive to legislators.
Check it out, folks. Go online, insideinvestigator.org. You'll see the story there from the Connecticut Inside Investigator. $82.2 million spent in State House lobbying. And Catherine Revelo's bill breaks it all down with some great charts, too, and some really understandable stuff there. Hey, Catherine, good to have you on, and we'll check down the road. Thanks for the good work. Keep it up.
Thanks, Paul.
Appreciate it. Catherine Revelo there, ConnecticutNewsJunkie.com columnist, blogger. You can read him, as I often do, at Substack.com. Name of the blog is Red Meat for Mushy Moderates. Terry Cowgill joins us. Mr. Cowgill, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Well, I am currently trying to figure out who to vote for railroad commissioner.
So, Texas.
we know that on the local level, there is no Democratic or Republican way to fill a pothole.
Yeah.
The question is there a Democratic or Republican way to run a railroad?
Well, there you go.
I have not answered that question.
What's
yet.
That old phrase? That ain't no way to run a railroad. So you might be onto something, Terry. You might be. You might be.
Well, that's what I'm hoping. I mean, there's just so many questions here. And, of course, the dominant race is Ted Cruz and Colin Allred for the Senate. And that's getting a lot of press here. But, you know, we're just moving along here in Texas. You know, things move at kind of a slow pace. And the heat is still here every day. It's in the 90s. So.
But it's a dry heat, Terry. And when people used to say that, I used to say, yes, so is your toaster oven, but it's still hot. Yes.
That's right. Yeah. It's still, you don't want to walk around barefoot at all because you just get, you get third degree burns on your feet. So,
what is your sense, Terry? It's interesting you mentioned that Colin Allred, you know, his storybook guy, he's a great on television. He does great interviews, played college and pro football versus Ted Cruz. Like, Ted Cruz is always forecast to lose, and he hardly ever does. What's the deal with that?
Yeah, well, he Cruz, you know, that's the thing about Texas. There's a sort of a myth out there that it's a, you know, a ruby red state, and it's really not.
Yeah.
Because all of the big cities are run by Democrats, even though technically, you know, municipal races in Texas are nonpartisan. But the cities are all blue,
mm-hmm.
And the suburbs are kind of a mix. But there are hundreds of rural areas which are ruby red country.
Yeah,
and it's just enough to, you know, like there. I would say that's maybe it's certainly in the state legislature. It's probably about 3-2 Republican mm-hmm. in both the House and the Senate. So it's not a complete wipeout, but it's just enough that it's a mm-hmm. real challenge for. Democrats to win statewide office, and indeed no one has won statewide office, no Democrat has, since I believe 1994.
Wow.
So it's been about 30 years. Yeah.
Jeez. You have a new piece here, apropos of nothing, some things are more important than the Veep debates. Terry, this is at your Red Meat for Mushy Moderates. Please explain yourself.
Yeah, well, I did watch, in fact, the vice presidential debate between Tim Walz and, mm-hmm. and J.D. Vance. And then I just, you know, things started happening with in Israel. Certainly Iran launched a ferocious attack against Israel with all of these missiles, hundreds of them. And I just thought to myself, you know, that vice presidential debate just seems exceedingly small now.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm certainly worried that Israel is going to be drawn into a much larger conflict here. And of course, today being the 1 year anniversary of the October 7th massacres, it takes on added urgency. I think that certainly Israel is being very aggressive, and it is amazing. The division that it has sowed in this country, you're not going to please anybody. There are people who are pro-Hamas, mm-hmm. anti-Israel, mm-hmm. who hate Joe Biden. They think he's a shameless hack for Israel. Mm-hmm. And then you look with the Republicans, and they're all saying, "Well, he's not supporting Israel. He's pro-Hamas."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's hard to tell what the truth is. And I think the truth is he's trying to thread the needle. And it's a real tough road to walk.
Well, and yeah, and they're worried, Terry. Now the Harris campaign is worried about the blowback here. And now I'm reading a couple of things from, you know, relatively believable sites, not on the far left or far right, saying, you know, Michigan is way too close. It should never be this close if you're a Democrat.
Well, exactly. And of course, Michigan has the largest Arab population, Arab American population, in the country. So that's a big one. And, you know, certainly Harris needs Michigan. She Biden carried it in 2020, I believe, by several points. But the domestic political implications are enormous. And then, of course, also in this piece, I talked about the dock worker strike. And, you know, the thing that's amazing to me, and look, I don't have a problem if they want to, you know, make more money.
Yeah.
But these provisions they want to put into a new contract against automation. I mean, what are these people, crazy?
Well, they may be.
I mean, this is insane because, you know, if we went by that logic, there would be Henry Ford would have never invented the assembly line, you know. And why would we even invent the wheel?
Yeah.
Let's just hire extra workers to pick things up and carry them around. Cranes are automation. I mean, I don't understand and how they think they can actually get away with this.
But, and the union head, Harry, lives in like this $7 million house with a 5-car garage, and he has a Bentley. You can't script this. It's great. You can't script
this. Right, one of the union bosses was tweeting from, I believe, somewhere in on the South Texas coast from his condo. Talk about bad optics. You know, that guy needs a lesson in public relations.
And in the couple of minutes we have left, you have something going live tomorrow. And really, Terry, I've had some funny phone calls on this. I've laughed about it. Now we're into I guess we moved on from eating cats and dogs. And now we're talking about what money is with FEMA, where, when, and why.
Oh, my God. You know, this has me really torqued off, because it seems like, you know, we've always had a problem with misinformation in this country, yeah, you know, dating way back to the earliest conspiracy theories. But it is getting really bad now. Time was, and you and I both remember this, because it hasn't been that long ago. It's only been about a dozen years ago after Storm Sandy, you know, hit New York and New Jersey.
Yeah.
Chris Christie met President Obama at an airport, and they actually embraced.
Oh, my God.
You know, they put aside their partisan differences, and they embraced in this time of tragedy.
Yeah.
But now what's happening? People are spreading disinformation about it to the point that, well, President Donald Trump was one of the worst offenders, saying that basically the federal government withheld aid to Republican disaster victims, and others warned. Oh, yeah, there was this one rumor that the government was going to bulldoze the affected communities and seize the land from residents in order to get rare earth materials for batteries. And that was completely debunked. Mm-hmm. There were all kinds of there was just all kinds of stuff out there. So I think one of the worst things, and of course, Elon Musk has been spreading, you know, conspiracy theories about this. Alex Jones, he of
Sandy Hook fame,
me started. Was one of the worst.
Don't get me going.
But you know, it's to the point now that we don't really know how to distinguish truth from fiction.
Yeah.
And it is being made worse by the fact that China and Russia are amplifying.
Oh, sure they do. Oh, sure.
And they found our soft spot, Paul. And it is social media, because they can sow more distrust and divide us through social media than any other possible medium they have.
Yeah. See, this is why, Terry, I try to limit myself to, on social media, cat videos and talking about hockey. And that's it. And none of the Chinese or Russian algorithms go after that. It doesn't. Their AI goes, what's hockey and why does this guy in Connecticut like cat videos? Terry Cowgill, ConnecticutNewsJunkie.com, Substack.com. The blog is called Red Meat for Mushy Moderates. Terry, be good. Keep me updated on that. Make sure you send me ongoing coverage, as we say in the business, of the agriculture commissioner race. Will you do that for me?
I certainly will, and I will pick some cotton in the meantime.
Thank you, sir. Have a good week. Thanks, Terry. Terry Cowgill there. Now part-time resident, splitting his time between Texas and Connecticut. Still a property owner here in the state.